Tonight, another look at the history of Rome. We've done it once or twice before. Why not again? I think Rome deserves it. We haven't fully exhausted the riches or the complexity of the history of Rome, and an examination of Roman culture in the sense of everyday life and Roman high culture in the sense of its great art, especially its literary art. I am joined, as once before in recent years, by Daniel H. Garrison, professor of classics at Northwestern University, and Edwin Menes, who is professor of classics at Loyola University. I don't know whether old Edward Gibbon was right, but if he was right, one might mourn the fact that we don't live, instead of the present moment, 1,800 years ago. 1,800 years ago would be 193. Maybe one should want to have lived 1,820 years ago, because 193 A.D. is the end of the age of the Antonines. It is, I believe, the death of, or was he killed, of Commodus, the last of the Antonine emperors. And here's what Gibbon says about that period. Quote, "If a man were called to fix the period in the history of the world during which the condition of the human race was most happy and prosperous, he would, without hesitation, name that which elapsed from the death of Domitian to the accession of Commodus, A.D. 96 to 180. Well, he thinks bad times began with the death of Marcus Aurelius, and Commodus follows him. But all the same, whether 1,800 years exactly or 1,850 or something like that, he says life was as good as it can get in those days in Rome, Gibbon says. I assume he means not really the city of Rome, but the total Roman Empire, which is just about all of the known Mediterranean world. Was Gibbon right or wrong?
Oh, I'd have hated to have lived there then, I think. You know, perhaps the condition of things like medical science, sanitation, and other things in Gibbon's day weren't much better than they were in the days of...
Well, Gibbon was writing in 18th century England, and I guess London was rather a cesspool.
I would, I think, much rather live now than then.
But the Pax Romana prevailed, whatever it was. I think what he's really referring to is that people had a sense the world is stable and life will go on, and we've kind of worked out all the rough spots and we finally learned how to do this thing, the thing being the management of the polity, the management of a total society.
There was a world polity. It wasn't a global polity, but it was a kind of ecumenical polity. The Mediterranean world and most of southern Europe, surely all of southern Europe, was included in this, up to the Danube and the Rhine. This meant that wherever you lived in a vast area, you were within a certain polity. You were a citizen or close to the rights of a citizen in a sufficient sense that you were secure in the possession of your future, secure in the possession of your family and your family property, and you could look at your life with a certain amount of expectation that it would continue and the life of your children would continue in a predictable way.
When they start beating up on St. Paul, arrest him and make trouble for him someplace in Asia Minor, he says, "I am a citizen of Rome. Take me to Rome. I must be tried there. I have that right." And indeed, he had the right, and they took him to Rome and they killed him.
It was a memory. The memory of being Romans persisted long after the death of the Roman Empire. For example, in Greece, until recent times, in fact, even now, Greeks will refer to themselves as Romans, Romaeoi, and the Greek, modern Greek language is often still referred to as Romaic. And this goes back to this very strong identification with the conqueror. In Greece, but not just in Greece, throughout this oikoumene, throughout this inhabited region, it was a very strong loyalty, and I think it tended to cancel all previous ethnic identifications.
Well, of course, it is common lore, and it's more than lore, it's a reasonable representation of reality, that the two civilizations that gave birth to Western civilization were those of Greece and of Rome. It's interesting to note that when Rome is first really getting going, and I think that's sort of middle of the 6th century B.C., indeed the Republic is founded in 509 B.C. with the expulsion, do I have this right?
Those are the traditional dates. Yeah.
In 510, the expulsion of the last king of Rome, and that was just a village with some kind of headman lording it over the others. That's what about all that Tarquin the Superb could have been, I think, in reality. But at the time of the foundation of the Republic, 509 B.C., you've already got great Hellenic civilization. It's just before the rise of Periclean Athens.
Yes, and you have to remember that even at that early a date, there were Greek traders, Greek commercial travelers, Greek businessmen involved in the development of the Roman polity. And so Greek political science, as we'd now call it, or Greek political and constitutional theory, was very much at work, even in those early times, creating a kind of polity which made it possible for Rome to succeed where all other polities had failed in Italy.
But the basic question that arises immediately is the Greeks had a real head start. They had great literature. If you go into the 5th century, the 400s B.C., that's the period of Greek glory. That's the Periclean polity in Athens, to which I've just referred. So many other Greek states are flourishing. And the Romans have just barely come down from those seven hills or whatever it is. They are by no means a significant presence in European life. How did the Romans overtake the Greeks? If at that point you asked, what will happen to those guys in that area called Rome or something of the sort, you would have been laughed off. If anyone knew who they were, the answer would have been, they are a trivial people. They're fighting with the Sabines and the Etruscans, and they're just tribal. They don't matter much. Yet, within 300 or 400 years, they were already dominating all the known European world, and indeed had conquered the Greeks. How? Why?
Well, the Greeks had great political philosophy. I doubt that they had great political science. I think the Romans were master organizers, master military people, very practical people. They knew how to get things done. They didn't bother to stop and think about it necessarily. I suspect that the impetus to think about things came from the Greek influence in Rome. But when the Romans saw a problem, they solved it. Often by the most direct means possible. Roman roads, for example, don't follow terrain. When they come to a difficult part of the hill, they cut through the hill. You know, I've heard parallels with Russian science. At least when Sputnik went up, I was told that when the Americans were attempting to put up a missile and didn't have powerful enough rockets, they attempted to miniaturize the missile, whereas the Russians built a more powerful rocket. That was the Roman way of doing things.
Would you want to settle for this basic distinction between the Greeks and the Romans? The Greeks were great in philosophy and they started science. And they started science in the 6th century B.C. Along the Ionian coast. Mm-hmm. Physics, as we know it, really begins there. And the Romans were nothing at the time. But the Greeks, perhaps, were so philosophical and so interested in the higher truth that they lacked that simple practicality that peasants coming down from the hills might have, and that may have been the difference from the very beginning of the contest.
The Romans were great pragmatists. The Romans believed in work in the way the Greeks never did believe in work. And the Greeks had a great love of science, but it was always abstract science. And it took this Roman pragmatic instinct, this desire to do a piece of work, to get a job done, to capitalize on what there was in Greek science that could be used. The Romans themselves, although they were very great engineers, were themselves limited. And this is one of the sort of long-term weaknesses that we see in even Roman versions of the Western civilization. Even the Romans never figured out a way to get work done other than animal power and human power. In spite of this, they were great road builders, they were great bridge builders, and they were generally great builders. They developed a form of concrete which is still unsurpassed. Roman concrete is one of the great technical achievements.
You'd want to add also, wouldn't you, Dan, instantly, that they were great soldiers.
And they were very good soldiers. And this is something that occurred to me as you were talking. The ability to subordinate your personal ambition to some higher goal was especially Roman and especially un-Greek.
Yeah, the Greeks really could never unify, of course. Greece in its heyday was a bunch of constantly warring states, and you might argue that they really softened themselves up for the taking in the dreadful Peloponnesian War, which wrecked much of Greece, and from which Greece... Well, it recovered because then the Macedonians, who weren't really Greeks, came down and dominated all of Greece, and indeed invaded Asia, mm-hmm. and Alexander's empire was a great but fleeting moment of glory. But beyond that, they were supine in the face of Roman power as it rolled eastwards.
Well, this is another aspect of Greek civilization. It was not really open to outside influences. City-states constantly at war, especially after... about the mid-5th century, a sense of the non-Greek being a barbarian in much of our sense. Whereas the Romans, from the beginning of their history, claimed a mixed founding, Roman and Sabine. The Etruscan influence is well documented. They were open to Greek influence as the Greeks came in greater numbers as South Italy was conquered.
And somehow the Japanese of the almost modern period come to mind as the Japanese Empire got going and before it got its comeuppance in World War II. They were famous for taking anything they could use and respecting all civilizations and borrowing from them and somehow integrating it into a Japanese mix. Are you suggesting something similar went on
something
with the Romans?
Something similar to that. There were good things to be found anywhere, and where they were to be found, the Romans used them. Romans, furthermore, and I don't push this as a case for learning a foreign language, but Greeks tended to know only Greek, whereas educated Romans, certainly from the Augustan period on, knew Greek at least, and as time went on, were able and willing to learn other languages to deal with the peoples they had to deal with.
Well, they felt strangely. Isn't this evident in Roman literature and in Roman history? They though they had conquered Greece and all of the world they knew, didn't they always feel a little bit one down in face of the Greeks? Felt the Greeks to be superior in culture and science and literature, and thus an educated Roman had to know Greek. Surely an educated Greek did not, say, in the first century B.C., have to know Roman, Latin.
The Romans did feel a certain inferiority complex, at least in what we call the higher culture toward the Greeks. On the other hand, they felt a certain dislike for individual Greeks. You know, one finds examples in Juvenal's Third Satire, for example, which is a satire on the condition of the city of Rome, plus or minus 100 A.D. The city is going to pot. You know, all these foreigners are living in what used to be fine old neighborhoods, and this man that is Juvenal's interlocutor is moving out. He just can't take it anymore.
But the ability of the Romans to absorb was one of their great strengths, the ability of the Romans to put things together, to absorb foreigners, to exploit the talents which foreigners brought. This is the great strength of Rome, and I think if you were looking for reasons for the development of Rome as opposed to any of the other cultures of the Mediterranean basin, this is surely one of the reasons you must cite: the ability of the Romans to make use of, to absorb, to exploit, and to include. It was a very inclusive culture, and that gave it the power to become the ecumenical force of the Mediterranean basin.
I gave the founding date of the Republic, at least it's the mythical date or whatever, of 509 B.C. It's much clearer that the Republic absolutely ends by 27 B.C. because that's when Augustus becomes primus inter pares and the princeps. He doesn't call himself emperor, but in fact all the power has been taken by Augustus, and from there on we can properly speak of the Roman Empire, which goes on I don't know how long. There's a great argument as to when the Roman Empire really falls. It spends 200 or 300 years in falling. But if you look at the Republic, and I invite you now to do so after we pause for a quick commercial message, and choose, I think we might choose a time, say a 50-year period when the Republic is solid and the culture is flourishing, and begin to examine what the Republic was politically, what it was in terms of the arts, what it was in terms of a way of life. What's our target year to look at the classic Republic before the Troubles?
About the period of the Second Punic War, I think, is where the Romans would have put it, the late 3rd century B.C.
But then we miss all those fascinating characters within 100 years of the end of the Republic.
Well, you ask when the Republic was solid. and the Republic was solid in the 3rd century.
But it only gets interesting a little bit later on, I guess. Well, we're going to look at both of those periods, the solid Republic, the Republic in trouble and producing great literature and great controversy and a lot of and great civil wars as well. So we'll pick up at around 300 B.C. and take it from there, right back after these words.
Again, Extension 720 with your host, Milt Rosenberg.
Nope. Thank you, Jack Taylor. Rushing through Roman history, let's choose a stopping point. You mentioned the First Punic War. I've just been checking it, and the dates on that are 262 to 242 B.C. What were you saying about the First Punic War, that after it's won, then you've got Rome solidified as a republic?
The Roman historians themselves look back to the time after the Second Punic War as the beginning of the decline, so that the period, period between the wars and during the Second Punic War, they looked on as kind of a high water mark of the Republic. This is the age of Scipio, the Second Punic War, Scipio the Minor, who was the focus of a circle of writers, very influenced by Greek humanistic thought, the comic poet Terence, the historian Polybius is part of that crowd.
So he's a Greek, is that right?
He's a Greek, but he was...
he's come over to write a history of Rome.
He was a hostage in Rome.
Yeah.
He was...
probably a slave.
Rome. No, oh no, no. He was a prince, as a matter of fact.
Oh, was he? I didn't know.
but tremendously impressed by what he saw. And who else? The Stoic philosopher Panaetius, the orator Lelius, the satirist Lucilius.
Well, the First Punic War ends in 242. The Second Punic War begins in 218. So let's go to the year 230 or thereabouts. Mm-hmm. That's the high point of Republican Rome, is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
What's life like in the city of Rome and beyond in the many provinces of Rome in, say, the year 230 B.C.?
Well, in that time, Rome is beginning to consolidate its presence in the Mediterranean. They have not yet conquered Greece, and so you don't have the great influx of Greek statuary and works of art which characterizes a later period. But it is a period of growth, and one of the reasons why we can look at this period as a time when Rome was thriving is that Romans were great at growing. They were great consolidators. They were great growers. They were consolidating specifically their power down the boot of Italy, granting various kinds of federation to the various little cities and regions of the southern part of Italy, and therefore, Rome was beginning to be a place where things were happening. It was a center of things.
The city was sort of the Big Apple of that time.
It was the sort of the New York of the time. Of roads were leading to Rome.
All roads lead to Rome.
Which led to Rome. And the idea of a centralized power, the idea of a culture flowing from a single source, the idea of a single source of security, was very, very important to the people of Italy, who had always lived in a relatively insecure state.
Now, were the people of Italy by then Romans in citizenship, or did that come later?
Well, far later.
Yeah.
Far later.
They were allies, but they were subject states dominated by Rome. The granting of broad Roman citizenship is...
First century, after the social wars. The 70s is when the movement really began.
What's life like in 230 B.C. in the city of Rome? Here we are, the three of us, we're all academics. What would be the equivalent of that in that time in Rome?
The academics, the university academics, would be very Athens-oriented. The university people, students who had received a basic, what we'd now call a secondary education, would go on to Athens. And so a great deal of the cultural, intellectual life was still very much, it was a second city.
So if the three of us in earlier incarnations were something like academics in Rome, we would either have been off to Athens for a number of years on the equivalent of a Fulbright, or else we would be Greeks who had come to settle in Rome.
Most likely Greeks. This is an interesting period for a conservative reaction. There is, on the one hand, Cato the Censor, who is maintaining Romanism writ large, the tremendous distrust, at least a public distrust, of things Greek. A concern for the young men who are listening to these Greek philosophers lecturing down at the Forum. And on the other hand, in, around Scipio, there is a tremendous openness for things Greek. So there, it's a marvelous tension that appears right around 230.
In what sense was the Roman Republic really a republic? What was the political form?
Well, the political forum was the SPQR, Senatus Populusque Romanus. It was republican. It was based upon the conception which gave it its great strength, I think, of a distribution of power, not in the hands of a tiny oligarchy, but in the hands of a class, or really a series of classes, people who had property, people who had something to protect, people who owned land especially, and the base of power remained broad. In fact, as time goes on, we look at the social wars, for example, which were just mentioned, the broadening of the franchise, the protection of the lower classes against the worst of the abuses.
Well, did a common working man have a significant vote? Did he have a democratic right in any sense as early as 230 B.C., our stopping year for the moment?
Oh, sure. But the way in which it was exercised, in fact, guaranteed that the upper classes would dominate. A very interesting voting system. You had to vote in person. And the vote was by groups. The populace was divided, say, in one of the assemblies into 193 groups, and a vote was taken in each group, and then the votes of the groups were cast as a unit. And it happens that the centuries which had the wealthier, the more powerful people, numbered fewer than the centuries that had the masses in them. So there was perhaps often the reality of a more or less democratic system, but probably more often simply the appearance of a democratic system.
It was a Hamiltonian democracy. Mm. It was a democracy of the rich, the well-born, and the able, as Alexander Hamilton called them. And this remained the ideal of democracy for Romans, not a popular form, not something in which what the Greeks called the demos had power, but which was concentrated in the hands of the most respectable and the wealthiest, and therefore presumed the best educated and the ones who had the greatest interest in the welfare of the state.
This is WGN Chicago, Radio Chicago. My guest tonight, as we are discussing some aspects of the history of Rome, are Daniel Garrison and Edwin Menes, both in the classics departments of Northwestern and Loyola Universities, respectively. The social wars, you've made a few references to that. Mm-hmm. Where is that on the calendar?
The 80s, generally B.C.,
in the century before Christ.
Yes.
And that begins, does it, with the Gracchi?
Oh, the Gracchi begin...
They're a little bit earlier.
The period of unrest. The Gracchi are 130, 120 in there. It's then that the aspirations of the provinces begin to make themselves...
The Gracchi are sort of radical politicians who come to high power and begin to really reorganize the economic system.
Well, traitors to their class, they were called by the Romans.
Were themselves aristocrats.
Yeah. What did they do?
Well, they...
We should make clear it's two brothers, isn't it?
They're two brothers, and...
Tiberius Gracchus.
And Gaius.
And Gaius Gracchus, yeah.
They attempted to protect the lower class, as I was saying before, against things like enslavement for debt and exclusion from essential decision-making powers. They tried to revise the Constitution. This is the reason why they were both destroyed by the Roman Revolution, which they began.
They're sort of like what Bob La Follette would have achieved if he were president. That is, it's a populist revolt in a way, isn't it? And a patrician is the leader of the populist revolt and takes power and then begins to reorganize the economy in a way that will profit the poor people.
Well, it was I think less a populist revolt than it was a revolt of the middle classes, of the rising middle classes, those who were not very wealthy, who were not landed, but who were increasingly desirous of having a part of the determining voice in the polity of Rome.
Then, if you look for a parallel in later history, it might very well be England in the time of Cromwell.
Or
perhaps the French Revolution.
Or it might even be the French Revolution. After all, in the French Revolution, it was not the lower segments of the populace who had anything to gain. It was the merchant classes.
Now, whatever the Gracchi did by way of redistributing land and reorganizing rights, it produced a lot of trouble, didn't it, in terms of the destabilization of the established republican system.
Well, the attempted reforms of the Gracchi really didn't survive them. I mean, it was swallowed for 20 or 30 years. But the pressures, nevertheless, were there, so that they become the first symptom of what becomes a tremendous destabilization in the 90s, 80s, 70s.
And who are the important figures, and what do they do? Sulla is one name that is of considerable
significance. Well, Marius and Sulla are the two the great names.
They're both rather bloody characters, as I remember.
Well, they both turned out to be, in fact, very bloody-minded. You have a two-party system, except it's not recognizably a two-party system in any peaceful or constitutional way. It's a competition between two power groups in Roman society, neither of which is willing to yield or compromise to the other, and neither of which is able to conceive of any solution to the constitutional crisis short of simply eliminating the other group. And so we have these bloody periods in which either Marius's party is in power and is eliminating the aristocrats who are associated with Sulla, or you have the opposite. And the depredations made to the ruling classes of Rome during this period that we call the Roman Revolution were very severe. And it's one of the things that made it possible for Julius Caesar later on to come to power and to begin to design a new arrangement of things. The senatorial class had been so badly decimated by this civil war, which had gone on for decade after decade, that the decks were cleared and there was room for a new senatorial class, as unfortunately as it turned out to be, a new and weaker senatorial class.
Well, the time comes then to look at the rise of Julius Caesar, I suppose. We're skipping a lot of other important people, for example, Pompey, who is first Caesar's ally, and then Caesar turns against him, as I remember it, but finally gathers vast power unto himself. We might look at the career and the rise and ultimately the assassination of Julius Caesar, which takes us into a very different period in Roman history. And we'll commence with that or continue with that right after these words.
Again, Milt Rosenberg with Extension 720.
And we return to Edwin Menes and Daniel Garrison in our breathless survey of Roman history. But we haven't yet touched upon the area that the two of you work in, especially. That is literature. If you look at Latin literature, is this a fair thing? Until the time of Caesar, and even somewhat beyond, you don't get much great and significant literature. What you do get is largely in the form of, there are some historians, and you do get some great orators. Cicero, who figures in the time we're coming to, is certainly a great orator and also an essayist. But literature in the sense of high poetry and epic and satire, all of that doesn't really get started until the Caesarian period.
Well, a lot of it is lost. I mean, there was a tremendous literature in the 3rd century. We have Plautus, we have Terence from then.
We have two writers of stage comedy.
But the satirist Lucilius wrote, 17 books of satire, of which perhaps 600 lines are left. There was epic poetry, Ennius.
Well, I'm sorry to hear it, because it shoots down a beautiful generalization I was about to offer you, which is that literature flourishes in times of trouble.
Well, you can say that beginning with this period that we started out looking at, the Punic Wars, the Roman literary genius begins to appear in the horizon during this period of growth. It is In its initial phases, it's very much a derivative form. Plautus was an adapter. He was a writer of popular for the popular stage, but he adapted Greek comedies. Terence, who had a shorter and less successful career in the stage, we have only six plays, that's all he wrote. Terence died apparently while he was going over to Greece, or just coming back from Greece, to bring back more plays to adapt. The difference between them, Plautus was a great popular entertainer. Terence saw himself as a writer of great literature.
Plautus, as Eric Siegel has told me, and of course he's when he's not writing those popular novels, he is essentially a student of Roman comedy, and I think his important book has that very title,
Roman Laughter.
Roman Laughter, that's the name of the book. He tells me that Plautus was really a stage man. He was an actor, a director, a scene builder, and just in general sort of a Broadway character, or the Roman equivalent there.
Started out as a stage hand, as you say, and so he learned. He learned his theater in a practical way. He learned it from behind the scenes.
But the great writer, if you had, pardon this bit of sort of showbiz imposition on you, if you had to name the five most significant Roman writers, who would they be?
Well, we start with Virgil and Horace. After that, it's kind of up for grabs.
Well, and Virgil and Horace are both into the first century A.D., are they not?
First century B.C., but toward the end of it.
Yeah, well, at least at the beginning, at the time of the Caesarian troubles and the beginning of the Augustan Empire.
Well, you look at the Augustan age, beyond any doubt. If you're looking for world-class authors, if you're looking for...
Virgil and Horace, and who else would be on that list?
Concentrated achievement, most of all, Virgil and Horace. But I think you would have to include in this the writers of the Latin love elegy, such as Propertius and Tibullus. These are short of world-class authors, but there is a contemporary of theirs, Ovid, who, although he fell out of favor with Augustus and ended his life on the Black Sea in exile, surely had more influence on the centuries to follow than even Virgil himself. He was the author who was read with the greatest pleasure by the...
Well, he wrote about the most pleasurable human activity. His whole focus is upon love and sexuality, isn't
it? He's a love poet, but also has to be appreciated, I think, as the most popular of the carriers of the tradition of Greek mythology. His Metamorphoses was no less than a compendium of the stories of the Greeks. And the particular colors which he put on those stories were the colors which stayed as the Middle Ages re-educated itself about classical civilization, classical life and letters.
Now, if you add to those names, Virgil, Horace, Propertius, Catullus, if you add as well Seneca, Petronius, Martial, I'm not sure of Martial's dates.
Lucretius.
All of them are in that late 1st century B.C. and over into 1st century A.D., aren't they?
Martial is later, but...
somewhat later. Yeah.
Martial is later, Lucretius is earlier. Lucretius, the early...
Well, I'm struggling to impose that generalization that I was offering earlier, that a time of troubles, because everything is up for grabs and values are uncertain, does somehow stimulate literary genius more than a placid time.
Well, I wonder... Really, in the age of Augustus, how much values were up for grabs after the writers of the time were convinced that Augustus himself was a stabilizing force?
Well, there you had something else, I guess. Yeah. You had leisure and wealth.
And support for the writer.
Who was that famous multimillionaire who supported so many writers? Is it Crassus?
Well, you probably think of Maecenas.
Maecenas, Caesar's friend.
A friend of Augustus Caesar, Octavian, later to be given the title Augustus in 27.
Maecenas is the man I was searching for. Yeah.
Yes, Maecenas
was a patron of the arts.
Patron of the arts in his own right, but he was given the task by Augustus of overseeing the development of a building program as well as the development of the literary arts. The building, in other words, of an image of Rome.
He almost sounds like a cultural commissar.
He was a kind of cultural commissar. He was not so much a commissar of popular culture. It was culture sort of built from above, imposed by the great architects, the great designers, and the great poets. leaders, cultural leaders, rather than people who would reflect a popular culture. The idea really was to remake Roman culture according to the best ideals of the past.
It's a fascinating period, and I want to come to it, come back to it in an instant. But before we do, we've got to handle Caesar and that great epic story of Caesar's rise, of his assassination, of the wars that followed, essentially between Mark Antony and Caesar's grand
nephew.
Octavian, who becomes the first emperor, Augustus. How do you, in a few words, characterize the fascinating history of Julius Caesar?
That is difficult. It really is.
He made himself a public hero by pacifying Gaul. His Gallic wars, which he called the commentarii, simply commentaries with a perhaps a false modesty, were a record of his enormous and truly magnificent achievement in Gaul, in pacifying and demonstrating to the Romans the effectiveness with which they could include and pacify areas which before that were howling lands of barbarian hordes.
And the simple practicality and earthbound pragmatism of Roman genius is visible in his book, The Gallic Wars. The very famous first sentence is very practical and down-to-earth. All Gaul is divided in three parts. And he tells you what the three parts are, and he tells you what the troubles were, and then how he went about suppressing Gaul and bringing it into the empire.
It's also a tremendous document of self-advertisement. The whole thing is written in the third person, so that one reads the name Caesar rather than I throughout, and then the reader can't help but remember the name Caesar as a result of it.
He did, in effect, make himself the equivalent of the emperor, did he not? Before his assassination.
He made himself the equivalent of an emperor.
Or the dictator.
Partly, well, not really a dictator. I think he was very much interested in a real consensus. He was interested in rebuilding. He was not a purely cynical figure. He wanted to save the Republic. He wanted to make the Republic a viable polity. And it can't be emphasized too much that in the age of Marius and Sulla, in the closing years of the BC era, the Roman Republic was in a state of profound constitutional crisis. And it was very clear to, I think, everybody, including Julius Caesar himself, that nobody who did not have a strong personality and the ability to motivate, as Julius Caesar had motivated his armies in Gaul, could put it together. You had to have a monopoly of force, and you had to have the kind of charisma that could hold the military together.
So why did the boys go for him in the Senate that day and cut him to pieces?
Well, in part, it might be characterized in part as a conservative measure, some lingering desire for the Republic the way it had been, in large part a self-promotional measure of a party that wanted power itself. Some of it may have been personal dislike.
Shakespeare represents it that way. Who is it? Is it Cassius who rages why he doth bestride the world like a colossus? And I just resent the way in which he's gathered all power, and he is the first and only Roman.
Well, there's a lovely little epigram of Catullus, whose father was a personal friend of Julius Caesar's, and when Caesar was in the north, he'd stay at Catullus's villa. And Suetonius records that Catullus and Caesar had a falling out, which they eventually patched up. But this little two-line thing, in Copley's translation begins, Julius Caesar, you're a snot. I don't care if you like me or not.
What about the love story? The fascinating triangle, or is it a triangle? I have Cleopatra in mind. And Caesar, who apparently had a child with Cleopatra, the queen of Egypt, called, named for his father, Caesarion. And then later on, Mark Antony has an affair with her. By that time, Caesar has been murdered, and Augustus really establishes his power, Octavian establishes his power, mm-hmm. by finally doing battle with Cleopatra and her leading Egyptian general, who is good old Mark Antony, mm-hmm. and defeating them at the famous sea battle of...
Battle of Actium, 31 B.C., which is if there's any watershed date, I think this date might serve that purpose. Because after the Battle of Actium, Augustus, to be Octavian, had a monopoly of power. It was all over after the Battle of Actium. The Roman Empire was, for the last time, was in the hands of a single person.
What are we to make of the fabled allure of Cleopatra? Does that really play a role in history, or were the various courtings of Cleopatra politically rather than romantically motivated?
Well, they're certainly politically motivated, but you cannot discount the art of Cleopatra, the courtesan's art of Cleopatra.
Yet the picture we have of her on one particular coin represents a woman of no great beauty.
Well, this is often true of people who have great personal allure. If you look at them with a cold eye, if you look at them frozen in a static state, if you look at them in two dimensions, as you would see them on a coin, there is nothing to see. It's like being kissed on the telephone. It doesn't communicate very well via a coin. There was a charisma in Cleopatra. There was an art in the way in which she dealt with.
So you think Mark Antony, at least, if not Caesar, was smitten?
Oh, definitely. The existence of this allure, I think, is visible in the fact that in the record that Octavian refused to meet Cleopatra alone. As if he was somehow afraid that her charms would be exercised on him, too.
Fascinating. Well, we come then to the founding of the empire. It's interesting. Channel 11 is once again running the I Claudius series, which, of course, gives you the whole history of Rome from the first emperor through Claudius the Fourth? Claudius, Tiberius, Caligula.
Augustus, Tiberius, Gaius. Claudius, Nero. It ends with the accession of Nero.
Yeah. The I Claudius series ends with the accession of Nero. So that takes us through the first four, or through the beginning of the fifth of the emperors. The Augustan age seems to work very well in, once again, stabilizing Rome, or Augustus achieves a great deal in the stabilization of Roman civilization. Just about all the empire has been won by that time, hasn't it?
Very much.
Yes, the only thing that happened under Augustus was the extension of that Roman frontier to the Danube, all the way over to the Black Sea. So he was a consolidator, but his general policy, rightly taken, I think, is that the empire should not try to expand beyond this point, this much and no further. This is the definitive border of the Roman Empire, and beyond that, the emperors of the later periods were simply maintainers of the Pax Romana within that area.
Well, now, if you go back to the city of Rome and to its artistic life and its high culture, as commissioned by Maecenas and as controlled in some part by him, mm-hmm. but a lot of very bright and talented young men, there are no women of whom we've got extant literary material, I think. What's her name?
One, Sulpicia.
I've never heard of her. Who is she?
We have, about 32, 36 lines of love poetry. She was a niece, apparently, of Messala, who was the patron of the love poet Tibullus. Mm. And it's apparently sheer chance it's preserved, even those few lines that they have.
But if you go to that artistic circle in Rome during the reign of Augustus and beyond, then you hit some of those great literary figures we were talking about. And the central one, I guess, is Virgil, not merely because of his poetic talent, but because of the task that he undertook, which was really to provide an epic history of the founding and building of Rome, and he made most of it up, didn't he?
Oh, no, there was a tradition. There was an Aeneas legend in Rome. What Virgil did was adapt it to several of the purposes he had.
Well, more properly said, he didn't make it up, but it was mythic material, yes. And it had very little to do with the actual history of Rome.
Yeah, so far as we can tell. I mean, in actual historical fact, it sets the foundation of the city and of the people far earlier than it could possibly have happened. But Virgil had a variety of aims in the thing. I mean, in literary terms, he was combining a certain Roman historical tradition with an epic of Homeric scope. And
he's making a very basic assertion about their origins. He's saying, we are Greeks, or rather, we are Trojans.
No, we are Trojans. Yeah.
Well, Trojans were Greeks of a sort, were they
not?
But
no, the conquered now will conquer the conquerors. The Greeks had conquered the Trojans, now the Trojans will come back and do away with the Greeks. The view of the Greeks that Virgil presents in the first six books, at least, in his depiction of the fall of Troy, makes them out to be liars, tricksters. I mean, his capital figure is Ulysses, who never appears, who never speaks, but who is always mentioned as the author of all the Trojan troubles. And this is the quintessential Greek. His mouthpiece is a man named Sinon, who is the one who convinces the Trojans to haul the Trojan horse into the city and so see to its destruction.
How good is the Aeneid as literature for a modern reader?
Well, the Aeneid is still world-class literature. It is perhaps the hardest of all the great works of literature to translate, and thus it belongs in a special category, perhaps set aside from such works as War and Peace, which translate very nicely. The Aeneid can be compared to a Gothic cathedral, which if you see only in floor plan, if you see only in elevations from the outside, you cannot understand the effect which the Gothic cathedral has on the emotions and on the spiritual.
It's Roman in
condition.
Its very first line, arma virumque cano, of arms and the man, I sing. That seems to me to put the stress on the two things that matter most in Roman civilization, military power and strength and virility on the one hand, and I read the man as somehow referring to those virtues of not merely of patriotism, but of what they called Romanitas, of good, solid citizenship and care in the maintenance of family and fortune. There's a kind of a Roman thrust in the very opening.
There's a Roman thrust to the personality, both the strength and the weakness of the principate started by Augustus. Was its dependence upon a central personality? I think you could say that Virgil's task in the Aeneid, perhaps it sounds too hard on the Romans to say this, was to give Rome a soul and to examine what the constituents of that soul were. And certainly if one had to put a single word forward as Virgil's answer to what Rome was all about, I think that word would be pietas. Translates rather feebly as piety, because we think of that as being a rather narrow religious attitude. But pietas was all of those attitudes of personal subordination, which I talked about before, as differentiating the Romans from the Greeks. This was very important, and this comes back to the rewriting of myth, which Professor Menes was talking about a few minutes ago. The revaluation of the image of the Greeks in comparison to the image of the Romans, particularly as it falls under the heading of Aeneas, Pius Aeneas.
We're talking about Roman literature. We haven't yet really sampled. We've got to stop in an instant for a quick commercial message. Have either of you come armed with some Virgil? If you have, pull some of it out and let's hear a little bit in the Latin and in the English translation.
Again, Milt Rosenberg.
Thank you, Jack. Dan Garrison has some Virgil ready to go. Here's a real challenge for you. We bollocked up our commercial schedule a little bit, and we've got to stop again in a minute and a half. Let's hear your Latin Virgil. This is the only program that dares to do 11 or 12 lines in ancient Latin. But after you read that, we'll take a quick commercial, and then we'll translate.
This is WGN Radio Chicago, presenting Extension 720. Again, Milt Rosenberg. Milt?
Thank you, Jack Taylor. Edwin Menes, what would you guess if Dan Garrison had just recited that in the middle of the Roman Forum in about 30 A.D.? Would they have laughed him to scorn or considered him a well-spoken Roman?
Oh, by then, Virgil was in the schools. They would have considered him a well-educated man.
No, but it's the accent I'm wondering about right
well,
now.
Well, we do, in fact, know a good deal about how Latin was pronounced, and that is as close as we can come to it.
How do we know?
Oh, a variety of ways. We have, first of all, descriptions of certain sounds. The rhetorical writer Quintilian, for example, describes the letter R as the litera canina, which means it was resembled a growl or a snarl, and that we presume was a trilled R.
It's a R.
R, yeah. We have not exactly bilingual inscriptions, but Greek inscriptions with Roman names transcribed into them. And it's kind of a double check. We think we know what the Greek sounded like then, and so the Greek reproduced.
So if it's transliterated into Roman letters, then that gives us some notion of the sound value of those Roman letters.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
And then some of it is reconstruction, too. If you take the Romance languages and work back from them, there's a certain amount of knowledge you gain from that, too.
Do you want to understand what Latin sounded like in Rome? Study Romanian, perhaps. Or the Romansh of the corner of Switzerland.
No, Romansh is supposed to be grammatically nearest Latin. I don't know if any of them reproduce the pronunciation.
Well, we're delaying on the translation of Virgil. That stirred me deeply. What did it mean?
Arms and the man I sing, the man who first from the shores of Troy to Italy, a refugee by fate, came. And to the shores of Italy, he much tossed about on the lands and deep by the force of the gods above because of the unforgetting wrath of Juno. And many things he suffered in war until he should build a city and bring his gods to Latium, from whence the Latin race and the Alban fathers and the walls of high Rome. And then he turns to the muse, his constant companion. Muse, tell me the causes. Because of what wounded divinity, and grieving for what did the queen of the gods, Juno, toss about in so many troubles, a man noted for his piety, for his pietas, forcing him to enter into such labors? Is such wrath possible in divine minds?
I am dazzled. You were just doing a sight translation, I think, weren't you?
This was just from the Latin, yes.
You were reading the Latin and, in your mind, translating it into English.
Reading the Latin, speaking English, just like a United Nations translator.
Well, that is wonderful. And you did very well with it, I must say. Did you actually maintain the meter all the way, do you think?
No.
But you're not. That's not required. Let's sample some of the Roman writers of more or less that time.
Well, I take this ode of Horace as something of a final political statement on Horace's part, where Virgil took, in a sense, the high road, the grandiose themes of patriotism in Rome. Horace saw himself as possessed of, I think he called it a musa pedestris, a muse that walks on foot. And at the end of his fourth book, he delivers something of a final statement that responds even to the idea that Horace might write epic, which, of course, he refused to do. This last ode in Book 4 begins, Phoebus volentem proelia me loqui victas et urbis increpuit lira, ne parva tirenum per aequor vela darem. Tua caesar aetas fruges et agris retilit uberes et signa nostro restituit Jovi de repta partorum superbis postibus et vacuum duellis Janum Quirini clausit et ordinem recte vaganti frena licentiae injecit emo vitque culpas et veteres revocavit artes. And it goes on for some
time. Are you going to do a sight translation?
No, I'm cheating. I have a bilingual edition. those particular lines, as translated here by James Michie, begin, wars won and towns sacked, high were the themes I had planned. Then Apollo twanged his rebuking lyre. Stop, little sails like yours should never challenge the Tuscan, the epic ocean. And he then turns to the sort of peaceful accomplishments of Augustus, rich fruits of the countryside, settlement of the Parthian War, closing of the Temple of Janus, and so on. And at the end of the ode, he pictures himself as in the audience, as standing by the side of the road as Augustus leads his triumph through the city, being one of the multitude to add his praises to this magnificent piece that Augustus, now in 13 BC here, has created.
It's by this time and onward for the next few centuries that you get some fabulous historians. Indeed, Livy comes even earlier, doesn't he?
Livy is about contemporary with Virgil.
Yeah. And then Sallust is earlier still.
Sallust is earlier. Yeah.
But then comes Tacitus, and later still Suetonius, whom you can call either an historian or a biographer. But from both Tacitus and Suetonius, we get that image of the Roman court and of the emperors. Mm. Which we love so much, because their decadence, their madness, the rapacious women, the constant adultery, just the sort of thing that's so well represented both in Graves's novel I, Claudius, and in that BBC television treatment of it. So I think we might turn to those people, those emperors and the people around them, that Roman imperial aristocracy, and the historians who had so much to say about them, sometimes with considerable contempt.
Yes, Tacitus was a Republican to the core, and there was
something... He's looking backwards. He's writing after 100 AD, isn't he? Tacitus.
Yes, he's looking back at the early generations of the empire, of the principate.
But there are men around who were alive during some of that time and who've told him some of these nasty stories about Nero and about Caligula and so on.
Oh, yes, one must assume a very lively, you might say, oral tradition. Not entirely an oral tradition, but the memory was, perhaps green is not the right word.
You can say oral tradition, you can say rich loads of very juicy gossip.
Yes, and the Romans have always been gossips. And I guess, to be fair to the Roman Empire of this period, you have to say that to look at the history of Rome through the eyes of Tacitus is limiting in the way that perhaps reading a gossip column about life in Washington, D.C., might limit your understanding of the American politics.
Well, then I had Tacitus here within the year. Diana McClellan, who writes the I column for the Washington Post, did a book. She's a British lady who's got a fine eye and ear for gossip, and she came and regaled us with stories about the low ways of people in high places in Washington.
Yes, and you can certainly find that the life of the palace in the first century A.D. was spectacularly corrupt. But what does not come out so clearly in the pages of Tacitus is the enormous amount of conscientious hard work which was being done to consolidate, to normalize, and to extend the benefits of the Pax Romana.
Well, somebody does criticize Tacitus along just those lines and says what he gives you is a history of the Roman court and not of the Roman Empire, which went on as a rather stable and vast enterprise during all that time when the aristocratic Romans were consuming one another with lust and with rage.
Yes, and the whole thing wouldn't have been possible if it hadn't been for the enormous workload which Augustus himself took on. One of the interesting things is to remember that when Augustus won the Battle of Actium, he was scarcely 20 years old. He was scarcely more than a boy.
But as you go forward to some of the emperors in succession, there's no doubt that at least two of them, two of the first five, were really weirdos.
Yes, yes.
Caligula, Gaius Caligula, and Nero are pretty strange cats, aren't they?
Well, what's the phrase, gutter to gutter in three generations? One certainly finds that in the tales of the Emperor Caligula, who, you know, doubtless was mad. Nero
promoted his horse to be a senator, had constant adulterous or incestuous relations, incestuous with his sisters.
Well, and planned to build a bridge from the Palatine to the Capitoline, where the Temple of Jupiter was, so he could commune with his brother God when he felt like, and such things. Yeah.
And Nero, after all, did, among many other people that he had killed, arrange for the assassination of his mother, mm-hmm. who had everything to do with his becoming emperor in the first place.
There are some disputes, I suppose, is the best way to put it, about the point at which Nero went bad. There was the famous Quinquennium Neronis, the first 5 years of Nero's reign, which, when he was still supposedly under the influence of his tutor Seneca, which are not supposed to have been quite so bad, but certainly by the end he was more interested in self-aggrandizement than in running an empire.
And what you've got there also, fascinating touch on Nero, it's as if we had a president whose real ambition was to be leading rock singer, and insisted upon giving frequent rock performances. Nero was constantly performing before the Roman public and doing rather poorly, one gathers.
Yes, he had a fixation on his own promise as an artist and his own identity as an artist. And you can only conclude that this vast and still growing, economically growing empire was going on autopilot. The procedures, the sense of duty, the sense of right and wrong, which went on automatically without really very much guidance from the palace,
is what held things together and made it possible for that period under the Antonines that Gibbon writes about to come into being. This is still before that period that Gibbon looks back upon as being one of the great golden ages of the human race. So you have to imagine that in spite of all of the truly horrendous things which went on in the White House of that era, that things continued to go along. And I think the interesting question here to ask is, why?
All right, I'm very glad you asked it. What's the answer?
Well, one of the big reasons why is the security and the prosperity of the Roman Empire. It was the envy of the tribes of Germans to the north. It was the envy of the Gauls, and it made it possible for the Romanization of Gaul was something which was only begun by military means, but which was carried out because of the ability of the Gauls, of the tribesmen, the former tribesmen, under the Pax Romana, to develop a better life for themselves. And it was obvious to them, just as it was obvious to the tribesmen of Germany 2 and 3 centuries after this, that the West had found, and by this we mean particularly the Romans, the Hellenized Romans, had found a better way to live. They had found a way to ensure not just physical comfort, but a kind of spiritual satisfaction.
Well, I guess you're saying then that the Roman Empire did persist despite all the craziness back in the palace.
Well, there must have been able administrators in the provinces, too. One side of Nero's self-absorption is that he wasn't looking to lop off heads 1,000 miles away.
But that the Roman administrators throughout the Mediterranean world and far into Asia Minor and as far west as Spain and Britain for a while, that the Roman administrators did, in fact, bring the Pax Romana, brought a peace in which the struggles of lesser tribes were now suppressed, and in which, I suppose, the general level of material comfort and production increased significantly.
The people in the provinces didn't have to worry about warring neighbors. Certainly the Romans didn't impose their culture, but they certainly made their culture attractive to the local populace. Citizenship was a possibility for many of the provincials. It was, I suspect, a time of rising aspirations among the people in the provinces.
We have not yet invited phone calls, and we're running rather late on that, but obviously you can't do all of the history of Rome within the first hour. However, we will shortly be on to the phones, and now's the time, if you want to join in this conversation, to put a question, to give us a ring on 591-7200, 591-7200. The lines are open at this moment, and we await your calls. The area code, by the way, 312 if you're calling long distance, and then 591-7200. Right back after this.
Again, extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg.
Thank you, Jack Taylor. And we return to Edwin Menace and to Daniel Garrison, and shortly on to your calls on 591-7200. We've got to do a lot in very short space, in about 5 minutes. All we've got to do now is account for the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, on which Gibbon wrote his classic multi-volume book. 6 volumes, 7, I forget, but a long book, of which the Duke of Norfolk, I think it was, got off that wonderful line when Gibbon produced the second or third volume. Ah, Mr. Gibbon, another damn thick, fat book. Still scribble, 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 eh, Mr. Gibbon? If we started with the Age of the Antonines and agreed that was a pretty good period, at least Gibbon thought so, and things were pretty stable up until the end of the second century, but then things begin to come apart. I don't know what you take as the date for the end of Rome. You can play this in various ways. Alaric the Goth sacking Rome, does that sort of...
Well, that's in 410. That is more symbolic than substantive. I think the date most people would look at is 476, a little later. The end of the 5th century, the last Roman emperor, Romulus Augustulus, a very ironic name for the last of the emperors, is simply pensioned off, and there is no more emperor in the West.
Of course, there is another Rome in the East. The empire is separated into two divisions some few hundred years before that, and Byzantium is the Rome of the East and indeed continues until the Turks...
1452.
In 1452, yes. Knock over Constantinople. And for Gibbon, in his famous Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, that's the end of Rome, but that seems a little a rather fanciful construction. The Rome we're talking about is gone by 500 A.D.
Yes.
Though it persists, of course, as it does to this day, and the culture persists, now transformed into and through Christianity. But what accounts for the decline of Rome in those 300 years from 200 to 500 A.D.?
Well, I think you've got to distinguish between Rome as a political entity, which certainly is what disappeared, and Roman civilization, or many aspects of it at least, which continued and changed and developed as civilizations do.
And gives the very substance of the high culture of Europe from that point on till the Renaissance, at least.
Yeah.
Still, as a political order, why did it come apart?
A variety of things. Externally, there's the pressure of the non-Roman peoples, which aren't answered internally by the ability of Rome to defend its borders any longer. That's certainly one part of it. There's a visible economic decline. One sees manifestations of this in things like Diocletian's edict on prices, you know, an early attempt at price control that failed then, as more recent attempts have failed. I don't know enough about the particulars to be able to discuss in any knowledgeable way in what particular aspects the economy declined, but
we've mentioned Gibbon. I've mentioned Gibbon a number of times tonight. We might, for the moment, entertain Gibbon's hypothesis. He has a very complex answer to that question, why did Rome fall? But the key element in his answer is Christianity killed it.
Yes, Gibbon as a philosophical writer of a kind of British Enlightenment believed that Christianity was one of the forces which spelled the overturn of the Pax Romana and of the Roman idea as a political entity. And I think this is because he, as seeing Christianity as a non-worldly, as an otherworldly kind of ideology, as an ideology which takes the minds of people off the business of the world at hand and puts them on the track of looking at some future life, some future existence, that life is merely a preparation for death or for the afterworld.
Gibbon was very hostile to this. In a fine old hymn, "This world is not my home, I'm only passing through." And if you really take that seriously, then the business of building and maintaining an empire and the daily practical work of establishing and solidifying power is not going to be pursued in quite the same way.
This is perhaps the least substantiable of all of the many dozens, literally, of reasons that Gibbon discusses in his multi-volume essay. That's what it is. It is an essay. And it wouldn't have taken so many volumes and so much scribbling if the problem had not been as complex.
But there's another great theme of historical interpretation. You get it before Rome even really rose. Thucydides has it in his history of the Peloponnesian War in Greece. Polybius is of the same mood. And later Roman historians are of that same mood, and it's the sort of cyclic theory of civilizations, that any civilization which extends its power and dominates other peoples will eventually undermine itself for two different reasons. One, the lines of supply are simply drawn out too far. You can't maintain control over thousands of miles. And the other is the prosperity that comes with conquest produces ultimately a kind of decadence and a weakening of spirit, so that the simpler and more vigorous tribes on the border will always eventually come at you and knock you over. That nothing so fails like extended success.
Certainly the image of prosperity which the Germans saw across the Danube and across the Rhine was irresistible. It was particularly irresistible when you keep in mind that the Germans themselves were under great population pressure, and they literally physically spilled across the Rhine.
So their attitude was, man, let's go get ourselves some of that.
It was admiration rather than hostility. There was hostility. There was a feeling almost of envy and resentment that the conquered peoples were happier than the people who kept their pride. There's a wonderful quotation I have from an earlier Roman writer about the envoy of a savage nomad warlord from the steppe of southeastern Europe. He said to remark this to the Emperor Justinian. He says, in your empire, it happens that there is a superabundance of everything, including, I suppose, even the impossible. And this is a man who would chase his enemies, who were poor nomads like himself, across the imperial frontier. But he at once regretted that he had done this. He saw that so far from injuring them by driving them off the steppe, he had done them the greatest of services, for he had driven them into the Roman provinces where they'd enjoy a higher standard of living than he himself could ever hope for. So he saw himself dragging out his life in an unproductive wilderness while his defeated enemies, as he said, will have the power to traffic in grain and to get drunk in their own wine stores and to live off the fat of the land. Yes, and they will be able to go into the baths and wear gold ornaments, the villains, and will not go short of fine embroidered clothes. And this was the good life. And the Germans came across and they invaded and they poured into the northern reaches of the empire to have a piece of this action.
That's a lovely quotation. Where's it from?
This is from Procopius, a third century writer of the wars of the northern regions.
Before we get onto the phones, and I promise all who are waiting will be there almost instantly, if one had to generalize from Roman history and draw from it some laws of history, of some laws concerning the rise and fall of civilizations that are applicable eternally and which we might well pay heed to at this time, what would such laws be? What do we learn from Roman history, apart from the pleasure of knowing the history and enjoying the products of Roman civilization?
Well, one of the things you have to remember is that any culture which stays alive because it has many participants. It has political participants, it has economic participants. It has a reasonable distribution of the benefits of a particular order of things. And one of the fatal defects of the late empire was that the rich were getting richer and the poor were getting poorer. And that in that situation you get what the Marxists referred to as class war. I don't take a particularly Marxist interpretation of this, but no one could deny that there was a lack of disunity. If you were going to, Michael Grant has a recent book that's in front of us here on the fall of the Roman Empire, and he reduces the explanation for the fall of Rome to a single word, and that's disunity. You have disunity when you have an alienation of one class from another. You have disunity when you have the alienation of one regional group from another. And you have disunity when you have the concentration of power in a single personality, the personality of the emperor. This is a fact which was recognized long before this, that a constitution which does not provide for an orderly succession, and a constitution which is essentially a monarchical form of government is fatally weak. And that basic political fact came home to roost in the Roman Empire.
Gee, on that basis, for the moment ignoring any possible applications to the United States, you might well predict that the Soviet Empire won't last for another 20 or 30 years.
It depends on, I think, the sense of the subjects of being somehow participants in this grand enterprise. This is the you know, corollary of what Dan just said. In Rome, as Rome became generous with its citizenship, generous with its civilization, opened it to all comers, I think there was a sense in all reaches of the empire that, you know, we are all Romans, we all have a stake in the continuation of this civilization.
But still later, social inequity destroyed that sense
of
identity.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah. We will pause right now. I think you've drawn the proper lesson, and it's a fascinating one, and surely one worth pondering for its applicability to this time and this place, and other places in this time. But at the moment, we will pay brief deference to the gods of commerce, and then right on to the telephones. 591-7200, right back after this.
Extension 720, once again, Milt Rosenberg.
Milt. Thank you, Jack. Back to Daniel H. Garrison and Edwin Menace, and directly onto the phones, and our apologies for those who've been waiting. Here is the first. Good evening, you're on the air.
Oh.
Yes, sir.
I think I have maybe a three-part question or three questions. My knowledge of Rome goes only back to high school and had 4 years of Latin. And I seem to recall that the Romans that we read quite often referred they were different, and if I'm not mistaken, even may have referred to an Italian language as opposed to Latin. Is this correct?
The Italians, let's see. One of the big movements of the first century B.C. was the extension of Roman citizenship to Italy. And one of Virgil's great themes, probably more in the Georgics than in the Aeneid, is that Rome is an Italian thing, and that Rome and Italy, the destinies of both are somehow intertwined. So that from that time, at least, this sense of separation between Rome and Italy just simply disappeared.
The language was the same.
Well, there were many languages. In fact, we think of Oscan and Umbrian. We know Livy, the great historian of the Augustan age, learned Latin. He came from Padua in the north, and he spoke Paduan. And so it was.
Were they not all Italic languages? Weren't they all cousin languages?
Yes, they were related. Yeah.
When I hear Italian spoken today, it reminds me as much of Latin rather as Spanish or half a dozen other languages. I would expect it to sound more like it, but it doesn't.
Well, I think modern Italian is descended from Latin, but it's gone through much transformation.
In that light, the Catholic Church seems to be one of the main organizations that kept Latin alive. And in that light, it changed the pronunciation of Latin, didn't it? And one thing also is, how come the Catholic Church got stuck in time speaking Latin, whereas the rest of the world slowly, at some point in time, diverged?
Probably for the same reason that lawyers speak a language that few of us can understand. The meanings of the words were very precise, were well-defined, and Latin was the official language, the language in which pronouncements were made, decrees were given, because the meanings of the words were known. They didn't have to suffer translation from Italian into whatever. One could start with Latin and then proceed into a variety of languages. Also, there is I think not simply in the Catholic Church, but in most civilizations, a certain conservatism in the language of law and of religion. There is a sense about religious language that it's somehow sacred, that it isn't supposed to change, and so there's a great effort put into maintaining what it was. One has the example, for example, of Sanskrit, which is a religious language. And from the 5th, 4th centuries B.C. on, there were tremendous attempts on the part of Hindu scholars to describe the language accurately so that it wouldn't change.
Our thanks to the caller, and let's dash on to another. Good evening. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Pleasant program tonight. I'd like to make a comment and then ask a question of your scholars.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope you won't consider me ungracious, but one evidence, I think, of the impact of Roman influence on our world today is, as I sit here looking through a flower catalog planning my spring planting, is the enormous amount of Latin in this popularized flower catalog. I see the common daisy is Chrysanthemum maximum. The clover is the genus Trifolium. These are words that any Latin schoolboy would know. Primula is an early blooming plant.
My favorite botanical term, as I've once said before, and absolutely won Virginia Beatty's heart, she being a wonderful expert on urban horticulture, my favorite botanical term is Tussilago farfara, which is a kind of fern, and which is just about the most beautiful sound that I know in the spoken language.
It's funny, it sounds a little vulgar to me. I'm thinking of Hemericallis and Heliotrope. These are words that in Greek that your visitors will understand. And even specialists, botanical specialists, have come down to us with Latin names. Begonia, fuchsia, dahlia are known to us today in terms of flowers. Their names have become Latinized. Feminine gender, I suspect. I have a question, though, about the current thought, the current scholarly thought on the genesis of the name, the proper name, Oedipus. I realize this is dealing in folk etymology. A colleague asked me today if I thought that the term Oedipus, currently considered swollen foot, is really the prefix there, the first part of it, is really from the verb oida, meaning to know or have knowledge. Is there contemporary thinking, current scholarship on that that would move away from the notion of the swollen foot theory.
Well, the name is Greek, of course, rather than Latin.
That is true, but I don't have that much of a chance.
But it is true.
This kind of specialty.
It is true that there is a multiple pun here in Oedipus, in Oida and knowledge. Oedipus Rex is a tragedy of knowledge. So, yes, there is certainly good scholarly opinion to that effect.
Well, then I thank you, and a pleasant evening.
Thank you for the call, sir. On to another. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, Dr. Rosenberg, I enjoy your program very much.
Thank you, sir.
I wanted to ask you a question with Daniel Garrison. It's one of the questions I wanted to get confirmation on, because I use it as a quiz question. I asked, what was the age of Caesar when he got his first military command to go into Gaul?
The age of Julius Caesar when he got his first military command to go into Gaul. I can't give you that off the tip of my tongue. I was talking before about the youth, the great youth of Augustus Caesar at the time of the Battle of Actium. And I would have to guess at this off the top of my mind. I would say that he was still in his 30s.
I would say he was in his 40s. And this is what stuns everybody when I have this as a quiz question, because until he got into very deep debt and necrosis, he couldn't get the, he was a playboy because he was a rich man's son, and they considered him a playboy, and he couldn't get a tribune authority until he became into his 40s, and he owed Croesus so much money that the only way he could pay Croesus off was to get the tribune and go into Gaul and get huge sums of money so he could refund Croesus' loans.
That's a good quiz question, then. It's a little like a question about Abraham Lincoln, a person whose own career didn't get off the ground until he was well into middle age.
Well, do we in fact have the date of...
or something when he got that. The other question...
Well, hold on a minute, sir. Hold on. It would be terribly simple if indeed in the annals there is a specified date for Caesar's birth. Is there?
I'm not at all sure. 104?
I think of it as about the turn of the century.
Yeah.
And this would make him a man then, since the Gallic campaign started in, 58, this would give us some idea of the man in his late 30s, early 40s,
yeah.
In fact.
Our caller may be right, then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, the other question I was going to ask you is, how much has life changed? What is the largest sporting event in the United States attended by physical people in the United States today?
The contest of the gladiators in football.
No, that's absolutely wrong.
What is?
Everybody gets stung by that. There's only one physical sporting event where over 200,000 people attend, and it is not too much different from the 260,000 that attended in Rome.
Well, it must be a boxing match, then.
No. Who were the 260,000 people that attended the sporting matches in Rome? Where was that held, and who were they?
Well, you're thinking of the Colosseum.
Circus Maximus, the Colosseum only held 50,000.
The big races. I know that automobile racing is considered to be a big drawer.
We've gone from the chariots...
To the Indianapolis 500.
Indianapolis 500. But we still have over 200,000 people, and the football games only hold 100,000. So how much have we changed in the 2,000 years? And who was the sporting person that won the most money as a sporting contestant in the history of the world?
You tell us.
All right. There was a man who for 20 years won every chariot race he participated in and won 150 million silver drachmas by participating in all the chariot races and winning for 20 years in a row.
Who was that?
I want to get his name. I don't know his name.
It wasn't Ben-Hur, I can tell you that.
No, it was not Ben-Hur, but it's very similar. And this is something that happened. He was the toast of Rome at the time, and for 20 years, he was a leading chariot racer and never lost a race at the Circus Maximus. And he was showered with silver drachmas every time he won a race. He came out with something like 150 million silver drachmas because he constantly won all the races at the chariot races. And he was supposedly the sportsman who has won more money than anybody.
I got a wonderful book for you. If you haven't already read it, I don't know the name of the author. Perhaps either of my guests can help me. There was that fine series of monographs brought out by Cornell University Press, or at least edited by Scullard, who's a well-known ancient historian, and was at Cornell. And in that series, which runs to 12 or 15 volumes, each by a separate author, there is one on Roman sport.
Since the Aspects of Greece and Rome series?
Yes, it must be the Aspects of Greece and Rome. I don't know the particular volume you're referring to.
I have it at home. I've dipped into it.
What is the name of it? I'd like to get that.
I can't give you the name of the author, but it's Aspects of Greece and Rome is the name of the whole series. And these are done with scholarly responsibility, but written at a sort of a popular and interesting level.
So sign up at Loyola this semester. We're teaching a course in ancient sport.
Sir, we thank you for the call. And we'll dash on to another on 591-7200. If you've been trying to get through, we've now got a few lines cleared. Here is the next caller. Good evening.
Good evening, Dr. Rosenberg.
Yes, sir.
These people have been reasonably profound who have been calling in. I don't think I'll be as profound. I have an expression framed and hanging on the wall of my office that the statement was made by one of the Roman luminaries. It was mentioned earlier this evening. The expression is, there is no such thing as enough. I just wonder if either of these gentlemen know who it is. I don't mean to tease. I know the answer. Do you know offhand?
No.
Tacitus.
Mm-hmm.
And he said there is no such thing as enough. And I frequently think during the course of a day how true that statement is right now. The word taciturn comes from the name Tacitus, doesn't it? And can anybody tell me the evolution of that word?
Well, it means silent and tacit.
I would think the name Tacitus comes from the word tacit rather than the other way around.
Yes.
The word Tacitus is the adjective from the root takeo, to be silent. Tacitus himself was a member of the Gallo-Roman nobility. His father or grandfather gained citizenship, and
he married well. He married the daughter of Agricola, is it?
Julius Agricola.
Yeah, who was one of the conquerors of Britain.
Of Britain, yeah.
Is that statement of his, there is no such thing as enough, consistent with what you gentlemen know of Tacitus and the things that he wrote?
Oh, very much.
It is, huh?
Tacitus, generally speaking, Tacitus is a person who allied himself with what you call a Stoic opposition to the Principate and to the newer traditions of the Principate. And this is very clearly a kind of Stoic piece of morality.
Though it's probably uttered critically. He's really commenting upon the base qualities in human nature.
He was a man of character?
Oh, very much so.
Uh-huh.
Good, nice fellow.
Fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call, sir.
Right.
And on to another. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, good evening, gentlemen. I'm enjoying this discussion immensely. And my question is concerning the decline of the Roman Empire and perhaps of the United States. I know in the early days of the emperor, rather the empire, military service was, I believe, mandatory. But in the later years of the empire, the emperors used the services of different mercenary troops, and oftentimes the citizens wanted to have nothing to do with military service, as they wanted to just rather spend more time amassing their own wealth. I just wondered if you could comment on that.
Yes, this is one of the very important factors in the decline of the Roman Empire was the movement away from a citizen army to a paid army, but more importantly that a movement away from a citizen army to an army of barbarians, people who were called barbarians, people who themselves had not yet been included in the cultural community, and therefore had no personal stake in what they were defending. The reason for the reluctance to enter military service were very complicated, and in many cases had to do with the economic conditions at home. They weren't necessarily so intent on amassing wealth as they were on maintaining what little they had in the face of growing economic hardship and increasing taxation.
I see. Yeah, I've often thought about if there can really be any comparisons drawn between the United States and Rome on that issue, but it's interesting anyway. Well, and I thank you for your comment.
We thank you for the call,
and
sir.
I'll just to listen. Thank you.
And we'll be right back for more calls on 591-7200. Some lines are now available. 591-7200. Right back after this.
Again, Milt Rosenberg with the conclusion of Extension 720.
Thank you, Jack. And here is another caller. Good evening. You're on the air. Hello, are you there?
Yes. I was curious. The statements made that Rome lasted for possibly about 1,000 years. And in this relationship, I'm curious about how the government itself existed for this period. I mean, in the case of, like, the bureaucrats, how the government was able to carry on. How efficient was the Roman government compared to today?
The Roman bureaucracy was pretty much an invention of the age of the Antonines. It's rather amazing that Rome was able to carry on as long as it did without an official bureaucracy. Rome underwent several constitutional changes in its history, but in the age of the Republic, what we think of as a bureaucracy was the functions of the bureaucracy were fulfilled by the hangers-on, by the slaves, by the freedmen of the people who were in fact ruling. It's really with the age of the Antonines, the period of this extended Pax Romana, that the bureaucracy came into existence as a recognized career for individuals. And so really it's only from after 100 AD that the bureaucracy began to settle in, but it certainly settled in well enough to maintain local control, local administration through whatever might have been going on in Rome itself.
And you might look at that as a great Roman invention, which the world borrowed from that point on in history.
Well, I don't know if it's great an invention, but
well, without bureaucracy, I don't think you could run modern states.
That's true. That's true.
And it's certainly the continuation of the Roman Empire was dependent very much upon the equitable management of local economies. And without some kind of economic management and planning and assistance to areas that are impacted by such things as earthquakes, you really don't have much coherence. You don't have much of a polity without people who are looking after this kind of problem.
We've got about 4 minutes left. There won't be time for any more calls. I want to touch a few more quick bases with you. You're both active scholars, and though you've been talking about all and everything concerning Rome, obviously the work you do tends to specialize, and it might be of some interest. I know it is of interest to me. If we talk a little bit about scholarly assaults upon this vast body of history and literature, and what particularly each of you is doing. What are you up to these days, Ed?
Well, I'm working on the Roman poet Propertius, who is a fascinating sort of character, considered by many the most modern of the Roman poets, one who excited the interest of Ezra Pound, translated well by the, I suppose, most recent dean of American poetry, Robert Lowell. Fascinating for a number of reasons. A love poet who couldn't find himself, who felt confined by the genre of love poetry and felt constrained to go beyond. Much of whose poetry is a series of attempts, experiments, ways to get beyond this narrow genre that he had adopted for himself. Fascinating also as a poet who pushes the Latin language to its extremes. There are grammatical features of Propertius that the grammar simply throw up their hands at.
Can you think of a modern equivalent in English poetry, or if not modern, at least within our ken of a century or two?
Within a century or two, not awfully. There are certain features of Propertius that I find reflected in John Donne.
I see the point. Yeah. What are you up to these days, Dan?
Well, I am looking at a similar subject. Propertius was a love poet. I am concerned with the much larger cultural perspective, the ideas of love as they existed in earliest Greece, even prehistoric Greece, in the form of religious belief, right on down to the time of Ovid. And it's a time during which the Greeks took increasing account of such things as women in their life. The Greeks were somewhat contemptuous of women, and we end the classical perspective with poets like Ovid, who pass on to the Middle Ages some ideas of love which had theological implications, mm-hmm. as well as purely erotic ones.
And may really have led into the development of the romantic tradition.
Yes, they do indeed.
Yeah. I would guess that Ovid's The Art of Love may well have been, through later history, the single most influential of all major works in Roman literature.
Well, certainly Ovid had a compelling influence on the imagination of the Middle Ages. And it is through the cultivation of love that the Middle Ages developed not only as a theological perspective, but a perspective on human life.
With only less than a minute left and so much left unsaid, as of course we've attempted the impossible, and you've done very well with the impossible, I must say. What are some available works written at a popular and responsible level that those who really want to know more about Roman civilization might go to?
Well, we have before us here that we've been reading from a reappraisal of The Fall of the Roman Empire by Michael Grant.
And in fact, Grant has done about a dozen volumes on Rome.
Michael Grant is a very good and very successful
English
popular author.
Historian, yeah.
So if you're near the card catalog of your library, you might look at books by Michael Grant.
We are out of time. I've enjoyed it tremendously, and my thanks to you, and we'll do it again within the year. Daniel Garrison and Edwin Menes have been my guests. Lorna Gladstone produced the program. We'll be back with you again tomorrow night at 9 o'clock.